Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support, especially on this inclement evening. And while you may think that we ordered up all of this rain to set the stage for tonight's event, it's just a coincidence. And really, you don't need any theatrics to set the stage for Jamie Ford. He's such an evocative writer that as soon as you begin to read, you are transported to different places and periods. But you already know that if you've read his best-selling debut, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. I cannot wait for you to read Songs of Willow Frost. You get to meet Willow and William and Charlotte and Sunny and so many more for the first time. And you're about to embark on an emotional journey and read sentences so beautifully crafted that they will take your breath. We are delighted that the man responsible for this, Jamie Ford, is back with us tonight to celebrate the publication of Songs of Willow Frost. Would you please join me in congratulating him?
Wow. It's really cool to be in a bookstore for my book launch, because people don't realize it. When Hotel came out, it really was one of those sleeper kind of books, and so it was released without a lot of fanfare. And so on my release day, instead of being in a bookstore celebrating with readers, I was just home in Montana, and it was wintertime. I'm in my house, and we had a blizzard, an epic blizzard, that shut everything down, and so my own bookstore didn't get my own book for 2 weeks. And so I live in a fairly small town, and everyone knew that I was working on this book, and they're like, when's that book coming out? And I'm like, okay, here's the day. And when you've published a book, you have a certain credibility, but when you don't have a book to show your friends and neighbors and doubting relatives, you have the credibility of a 45-year-old just hanging out in your basement playing bass guitar, gonna make it big someday. And on my release day, some people, they did go to the bookstore looking for the book, and then they would text me and say, I'm here. Your book's not here. Should I swing by Kinko's and pick it up? Where is it at? And so I just kind of had to bide my time, and eventually I would get texts and messages rolling in as people around the country, friends and relatives, would stumble upon it. And so I remember getting one from someone, and they were at the Cincinnati airport, and they texted me, and they said, I'm at the airport in Cincinnati, and your book's here. And I'm like, yeah. And did you know that? I'm like, yeah. And like, were you in Cincinnati? Did you leave your book here? like I just, casually just place it on the bookstore shelf myself. So it was a moment of, take a picture to validate my literary existence. It was quite charming to hear that, and finally to have a release week where I get to do this. Thankfully Hotel did get some traction, and it did fairly well, and I tend to say that with that book, my book has a career. I'm just along for the ride. And I stole that from Pamela Anderson, who said, my boobs have a career. I'm just along for the ride. Which is apropos in both instances. But it's nice to have a second book. I have a matched pair now. It's nice to have a second book. To have that second book out there, it's like giving birth to a second child all over again. You sort of forget the pain and the agony and the breathing and the epidural and all that stuff, and then you go back through it again, and then it's the same struggle, but then it's the same joy, and then it's the same, a similar process of interacting with readers and interacting with media. And one interesting question Actually, two questions that have been coming up lately with regard to Songs of Willow Frost. Two questions that come up all the time now, and it's caused some introspection on my part. The questions are, why the young protagonist? Because I have another young protagonist. And that's an easy question to answer, because in Hotel, I have a very young character. In Songs of Willow Frost, I do have another very young character. And when I thought about that, that's the age I was at when I first had my heart broken. And, you know, everyone has these moments in their lives where there was a coming-of-age moment where, you know, at one moment you're playing with Legos and you're riding your bike, and then another moment you're aware of adult emotions. And that was a time, I mean, from the innocence of my first, you know, fifth grade crush, and I had a crush not just on one girl, but a set of twins. Because I figured, you know, the odds are in my favor that way, you know. Triplets were not available, so Heather and Holly Farrow. I just had the biggest crush on them as this goofy little kid that I was. And, of course, they both had a crush on my friend, Sean. I'm like, you know, can't one of you find him repulsive and me charming? But no, that was the first, you know, little tiny kid heartache. But that was also the age that I moved away from Oregon and I moved to Washington. I moved to Seattle between the fifth grade and sixth grade is when we moved. And we moved there in September. And I would love to go back and look at the meteorological record of that time and see what the truth is. Because in my mind, I moved to Seattle and it rained from September, and it didn't stop raining until April. It was just nonstop rain. And if those of you have spent time in Seattle, there's times where that overcast nature, it feels like that. But that was also the time at that age where I first saw some cracks in the foundation of my parents' marriage. And they later divorced 2 years later. But it was this moment as a young kid that I started to perceive things different. And so the question that comes up about, you know, why young protagonists, I think there's something magical about that age where there's a personal awakening to what's going on around you. But the other question that comes up a lot is, why Seattle? And the question that, as it was phrased to me, was, what is it about Seattle that informs you as a writer? Not just that I've set these stories in Seattle, but what is it about Seattle? What is going on there? And at first, I answered that question really quickly. It was like a 5-second answer. And then the next time I had an interview, it took me about a minute. And the next time it was like a 5-minute answer, as I'm realizing there is something about it. But on the face of it, it seems like this really absurd question, because there's so many writers that live in New York City, and you never hear of an interviewer asking Colson Whitehead or Jennifer Egan, you know, how does, you know, the ever-present smell of sun-baked urine on the sidewalk inform you as a writer, you know? How does that affect your storytelling? You know, what is it about that city? But the more I thought about it, there is something about Seattle. And it's funny, because Seattle is often ranked as one of the most literate cities in America. And I do think that has something to do with the weather. There's something to do with the rain and the fog and the drizzle and the moss growing in the gutters and the wet pine cones and the smell of wood smoke and this sensory deprivation climate that not only drives people indoors, but I think if you're a melancholic person, it'll drive you into your own thoughts a little bit. And I think that can work for a writer. It's interesting, because growing up there, it was the family joke that if I ever formed a heavy metal band, it would be called Melancholica. And I'd play, you know, while my guitar gently weeps, and while my drums rhythmically sob, and while I play my keyboard sitting alone in the rain at the bus stop, alone. But I was, you know, it was like mope rock at its finest. I was just a kid that kind of felt everything and was a little different in that regard. And so Seattle did have an effect on me as a person and later as a writer. But the startling revelation was when I moved away from Seattle. And so I moved away from Seattle. I actually lived in Hawaii for a number of years. And then I live in Montana. And I live in a place in Montana where we have 300 days of sunshine. And so it can be, you know, can blow and there can be snow, but it's blue sky. I walk outside in the summer, blue sky. In the spring, it's blue sky. But I still have this melancholic process to my writing. And that's when I realized it's always raining in my mind. And it doesn't matter where I go. And it's not just metaphorical. It's today I come to Denver and it's raining. You know, I step over here, it's raining. I step inside, it's raining. And I use that to my advantage. I enjoy that. And that's because I think writers are people that are perhaps creatively driven. They're a little different. And by different, I mean, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Raisin toast.
Raisin toast. That sounds nice. What did you have for breakfast?
Oatmeal.
Oatmeal. What did you have for breakfast?
Oatmeal.
Wow, oatmeal.
With raisins.
With raisins. With raisins, even better. It sounds so nice and warm and inviting. You know what I had for breakfast this morning? I had sadness for breakfast. As a writer, you know, you have melancholy served sunny side down and two strips of despondence, and you wash it down with a freshly squeezed glass of your own tears, you know? It's one of those moments where you realize there's something different about it, and that's okay. And Songs of Willow Frost, for me, was an exploration of that, was getting in touch with some of those emotions. And I did it for a reason, and the reason is very practical. The reason is there's a part of me that's really frightened of success, because some of my favorite musicians, I love their music when they had holes in their jeans and they had crooked teeth and they had ratty hair and they're living in a van. And as they get more and more success, I wonder if they're able to write such brokenhearted troubadour songs while they are, you know, staying in the penthouse at, you know, the Beverly Hills Hotel. So I'm conscious of that, and I think about that. I mean, I love Sting, and when he was in the Police, he had this raw intensity, and I think he's great, and I think it's fortunate we've all sort of grown up with Sting. But, you know, Sting now lives, you know, he has a home, he has a villa in Tuscany, he has a home in the Caribbean, he has a penthouse in New York, he has two homes in London, but he resides at Lake House, and not a house on a lake. It's called Lake House, like Downton Abbey. It's an English estate. And it was, before he bought it, it was owned by Lord Glenconner and Lady Grey. And so now this is, and I think of, how do you get back to feeling that raw intensity when you have so many good things happening? So Hotel's taking off, and it's enjoying its literary run. And at the same time, I'm wary that I won't be able to write something that has that emotional center. And so I really cut myself off from a lot of that. I went back to the taproot of who I am, which is a very emotive guy, and wrote this story. And another thing about Songs of Willow Frost that is a little different by design is the Hotel had a lot of the Japanese-American experience, where Songs of Willow Frost has a lot of the Chinese-American experience. And I did that by design. I say design, it makes it sound very noble. I just say I did that through sheer cowardice. And by that I mean I wasn't quite comfortable putting a lot of Chinese stuff in that first book because I have a lot of great Chinese aunties. And I don't know if those of you that have great aunties, especially Chinese aunties, you will understand that they are the most wonderfully honest people in the world. And I can walk into, you know, a family gathering and they'll just turn around and like, hey, you got fat. You know, there's no filter, and the criticism is love. And, you know, and it's this supreme honesty that, and it's just bold-faced honesty in front of everyone. You know, my cousin can come in and they'll just be like, look at that. You've never fixed your teeth. You know, you're never going to find a man unless you fix your teeth. I'll pay to fix your teeth. I'm your auntie, you know. If I don't tell you, who's going to tell you? So there's this beautiful honesty that comes out. And so with Hotel, I can kind of dodge around that and build up the nerve to really go there. And so I did. And so Songs of Little Frost is a very emotional story, and it's a very emotional Chinese-American story. And it comes from a place of personal angst, perhaps. And so there's a lot of that in there. And I got asked once in an interview to sum up my career in one sentence. And my first thought was, well, I only have one book, so slow down. But he was like, sum up your career in a phrase. And I thought about it, and I said, I think I get paid really well to break my own heart on a regular basis. And, you know, that's not a bad thing. You can kind of work that to your advantage. And so what I'd like to do now is I'm just going to read a little bit, and I'm going to attempt to break your hearts a little bit. Okay. And I promise that if I do break your hearts just a little, I always believe in rearranging the pieces and putting hearts back together in better working condition. We're going to start page one from the beginning of the book. I will give you a lot of preamble about this, but I kind of do that within the first page. I'll tell you it's set in 1934. William Ng woke to the sound of a snapping leather belt and the shrieking of rusty springs that supported the threadbare mattress of his army surplus bed. He kept his eyes closed as he listened to the bare feet of children shuffling nervously on the cold wooden floor. He heard the popping and billowing of sheets being pulled back, like trade winds filling a canvas sail, and so he drifted on the favoring currents of his imagination, as he always did, to someplace else, anywhere but the Sacred Heart Orphanage, where the sisters inspected the linens every morning and began whipping the bedwetters. He would have sat up if he could, stood at attention at the foot of his bunk like the others, but his hands were tied literally to the bed frame. "I told you it would work," Sister Briganti said to a pair of orderlies whose dark skin looked even darker against their starch white uniforms. Sister Briganti's theory was that bedwetting was caused by boys illicitly touching themselves, so at bedtime she began tying the boys' shoes to their wrists, and when that failed, she tied their wrists to their beds. "It's a miracle," she said as she poked and prodded the dry sheets between William's legs. He watched as she crossed herself, then paused, sniffing her fingers as though seeking evidence her eyes and hands might not reveal. "Amen," William thought when he realized his bedding was dry. He knew that, like an orphan child, Sister Briganti had learned to expect the worst, and she was rarely, if ever, disappointed. After the boys were untied and the last offending child punished and the crying abated, William was finally allowed to wash before breakfast. He stared at the long row of identical toothbrushes and washcloths that hung from matching hooks. Last night there had been 40, but now one set was missing, and immediately rumors spread among the boys as to who the runaway might be. Tommy Nguyen. William knew the answer as he scanned the washroom and didn't see another matching face. Tommy must have fled in the night. That makes me the only Chinese boy left at Sacred Heart. The sadness and isolation he might have felt was muted by a mourning free from the belt, replaced by the hopeful smiles the other boys made as they washed their faces. "Happy birthday, Willie," a freckle-faced boy said as he passed by. Others sang or whistled the birthday song. It was September 28th, 1934, William's 12th birthday, everyone's birthday, in fact. Apparently, it was much easier to keep track of that way. Armistice Day might have been more fitting, William thought, especially since some of the kids at Sacred Heart had lost their fathers in the Great War, or October 29th, Black Tuesday, when the entire country had fallen on hard times. Since the crash, the number of orphans had tripled, but Sister Briganti had chosen the coronation of Venerable Pope Leo XII as everyone's new day of celebration, a collective birthday which meant a trolley ride from Laurelhurst to downtown, where the boys would be given buffalo nickels to spend at the candy butcher before being treated to a talking picture at the Moore Theater. But best of all, William thought, on our birthdays, and only on our birthdays, are we allowed to ask about our mothers. Birthday Mass was always the longest of the year, even longer than the Christmas vigil, for the boys anyway. William sat trying not to fidget, listening to Father Bartholomew go on and on and on and on about the Blessed Virgin, as if she could distract the boys from their big day. The girls sat on their side of the church, either oblivious to the boys one day out each year or achingly jealous. But either way, talks about the Holy Mother only confused the younger, newer residents, most of whom weren't real orphans, at least not in the way Little Orphan Annie was depicted on the radio or in the Sunday funnies. Unlike the little mop-haired girl who gleefully squealed, gee whiskers, at any calamity, most of the boys and girls at Sacred Heart still had parents out there, somewhere, but wherever they were, they'd been unable to put food in their mouths or shoes on their feet. That's how Dante Grimaldi came to us, William reflected as he looked around the chapel. After Dante's father had been killed in a logging accident, his mother had let him play in the toy department of the Wonder Store, the big Woolworths on 3rd Avenue, and she never came back. Sonny Sixkiller last saw his ma in the children's section of the new Carnegie Library in Snohomish, while Charlotte Rigg was found sitting in the rain on the marble steps of St. James Cathedral. Rumor was that her grandmother had lit a candle for her and even went to confession before slipping out a side door. Then there were the others, the fortunate ones. Their mothers came and signed manifolds of carbon paper entrusting their children to the Sisters of Sacred Heart or St. Paul's Infants Home next door. There were always promises to come back in a week for a visit, and sometimes they did. But more often than not, the week stretched into a month, and sometimes a year, and sometimes forever. And yet all of their moms had pledged in front of Sister Briganti and God to return one day. After communion, William stood with a tasteless wafer still stuck to the roof of his mouth, waiting in line with the other boys outside of the school office. Each year, Mother Angelini, the prioress of Sacred Heart, would assess the boys physically and spiritually. If they passed muster, they'd be allowed out in public. William tried not to twitch or act too nervous. He attempted to look happy and presentable, mimicking the hopeful, joyful smiles of the others. But then he remembered the last time he saw his mother. She was in the bathtub of their apartment in the old Bush Hotel. William had woken up, wandered down the hall for a glass of water, and realized she'd been in there for hours. He waited a few minutes more, but then at 12:01 a.m. he finally peeked through the rusty keyhole. It looked as though she was sleeping in the clawfoot tub, her face tilted towards the door. A strand of wet black hair clung to her pale cheek, the curl of a question mark. One arm lazily dangled over the edge, water slowly dripping from her fingertip. A single light bulb hung from the ceiling, flickering on and off as the wind blew. After shouting and pounding on the door to no avail, William ran across the street to Dr. Luke, who lived above his office. The doctor jimmied the lock and wrapped towels around William's mother, carrying her down two flights of stairs and into a waiting taxi bound for Providence Hospital. He left me alone, William thought, remembering the pinkish bathwater that gurgled and swirled down the drain. On the bottom of the tub, he'd found a bar of ivory soap and a single lacquered chopstick. The wide end had been inlaid with shimmering layers of abalone, but the pointed end looked sharp, and he wondered what it was doing there. "You can go in now, Willie," Sister Briganti said, snapping her fingers. William held the door as Sonny walked out. His cheeks were cherry red, and his sleeves were wet and shiny from wiping his nose. "Your turn, Will," he half-sniffled, half-grumbled. He gripped the letter in his hand and crumpled the envelope as if to throw it away, then paused, stuffing it into his back pocket. "What'd it say?" another boy asked. But Sonny shook his head and walked down the hallway, staring at the floor. Letters from parents were rare, not because they didn't come, they did, but because the sisters didn't let the boys have them. They were saved and doled out as rewards for good behavior or as precious gifts on birthdays and religious holidays. Though some gifts were better than others, some were hopeful reminders of a family that still wanted them, and others were written confirmations of another lonely year. Mother Angelini was all smiles as William walked in and sat down, but the stained glass window behind her oaken desk was open and the room felt cold and drafty. The only warmth that William felt came from the seat of the padded leather chair that had moments before been occupied, weighed down by the expectations of another boy. "Happy birthday," she said as her spidery wrinkled fingers paged through a thick ledger as though searching for his name. "How are you today, William?" She looked up over her dusty spectacles. "This is your fifth birthday with us, isn't it? Which makes you how old in the canon?" Mother Angelini always asked the boys' ages in relation to the books from the Septuagint. William quickly rattled off Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, on up to 2 Kings. He'd memorized his way only to the book of Judith when he'd turn 18 and take his leave from the orphanage. Because the book of Judith represented his own personal exodus, he'd read it over and over until he imagined Judith as his forebear, a heroic, tragic widow courted by many who remained unmarried for the rest of her life. But he also read it because that particular book was semi-official, semi-canonical, more parable than truth, like the stories he'd heard about his own long-lost parent. "Well done, Master William," Mother Angelini said. "Well done. 12 is a marvelous age, the precipice of adult responsibility. Don't think of yourself as a teenager. Think of yourself as a young man. That's more fitting, don't you think?" He nodded, inhaling the smell of rain-soaked wool and mentholatum, trying not to hope for a letter or even a lousy postcard. He failed miserably in the attempt. "Well, I know that most of you are anxious for word from the outside, that God's mysteries have blessed your parents with work and a roof and bread and a warm fire, and that someone might come back for you," the old nun said with a delicate voice, shaking her head as the skin beneath her chin shook like a turkey's waddle. "But," she glanced at the ledger, "we know that's not possible in your situation, don't we, dear?" "It seems that's all I know." "Yes, Mother Angelini," William swallowed hard, nodding. "I suppose, since this is my birthday, I'd just like to know more. I have so many memories from when I was little, but no one's ever told me what happened to her. The last time he saw his mother, he was 7 years old, and she had half-whispered, half-slurred, 'I'll be right back,' as she had been carried out the door. But he might have imagined this. But he didn't imagine the police officer, an enormous mountain of a man, who showed up the next day. William remembered him eating a handful of his mother's butter almond cookies and being very patient while he packed. Then William had climbed into the sidecar of his motorcycle, and they drove to a receiving home. William had waved to his old friends like he was riding in a float in Seattle's Golden Potlatch Parade, not realizing that he was waving goodbye. A week later, the sisters came and took him in. William tried not to stare as Mother Angelini's tongue darted at the corner of her mouth. She read the ledger and a note card with an official-looking seal that had been glued to the page. "William, because you are old enough, I will tell you what I can, even though it pains me to do so." "That my mother is dead?" William thought absently. He'd accepted that as a likely outcome years ago, when they had told him her condition had worsened and that she was never coming back. Just as he'd accepted that his father would always be unknown. In fact, William had been forbidden to ever speak of him. "From what we know, your mother was a dancer at the Wami Club and quite popular. But one day she made herself sick with bitter melon and carrot seed soup. And when that didn't work, she retired to the bath and tried performing. Performing. His mother had been a singer and a dancer. 'I don't understand,' he whispered, unsure if he wanted to know more. 'William, your mother was rushed to the hospital, but she had to wait for hours, and when they did get around to her, the admitting physician wasn't entirely comfortable treating an Oriental woman, especially one of her reputation. So he had her remanded to the old Perry Hotel.' William blinked and vaguely understood. He knew the location. In fact, he used to play kick the can on the corner of Boren and Madison. He remembered being frightened by the ominous-looking building, even before bars were added to the windows and the place was renamed the Cabrini Sanitarium. Mother Angelini closed her ledger. "I'm sorry. I'm afraid she never left. Thank you." I don't want to give away too much, but in the next couple pages, it involves him seeing the actress Willow Frost, who he believes to be his mother. And the story is one of William seeking out the truth of that relationship, and it's also the story of Willow. And I'll kind of just stop right there. No one's read the book. I don't want to give away any crazy spoilers. But thanks for letting me read that. I normally only read like a page and a half, and so I'm allowing myself to read a bit longer. And I read really short pieces normally, and I do that because I have this personal theory paranoia that because we were all read to as children at bedtime, one of these times I'm going to go one page too long and I'm going to look up and it's just going to be like, and I don't want that to happen, so I don't want to read too much. I also did a book event in Florida one time, and the sweet cotton-haired lady in the back half stood up in her chair as I was about to read and yelled, "We already know how to read!" It made me look forward to that age where you can just, there's no filter and you can just say whatever you want in any social circumstance and it's okay. So, we all have that forward to look forward to. With that, I'd be delighted to answer any questions. And, please have questions. I've learned when no one has questions, only the crazy people start asking questions. And they're always like rhetorical statements, and I never know how to deal with those. So, yes, please.
How long was it between finishing Hotel before you started?
How long was it between finishing Hotel and starting this book? Oh, I don't know, 70 years, 80 years. In author years, I think you multiply it by, 14 or something like that. It was 1.5 years, 18 months. It's kind of hard because with Hotel, I had finished it, and then its release date is actually a year, 14 months later. And so even with Willow, I'm here today, but it was out of my brain and in the hands of my editor 14 months ago. So going back in time and looking at the calendar. But there was a good while there where I worked on this next book, and I had started the next book while Hotel was in the process of being published, and then I was finishing it up, and then suddenly Hotel takes on a life of its own, and at first I'm writing in anonymity, and then shortly thereafter I'm getting emails from readers that say these beautifully indelicate things like, "I'm 87 years old, and when's your next book? I'm not going to be around forever, I'm in my iron lung. Come to the ICU and give me that book." No pressure at all. So suddenly, the degree of the intensity of pressure was ratcheted up a little bit. And it took me a while to circle the wagons as a writer and kind of isolate myself from that feedback and get back to the act of storytelling without a lot of that other sensory stuff going on. Yeah, please.
Are you currently working on another book?
Am I currently working on another book? Always. I'm working on a book that's currently untitled, and it deals with... I'm working my way back in time a little bit. This new book starts out in 1909, and it's another Seattle book. And it's set between the two World's Fairs in Seattle, the AYP, the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, which happened in 1909, and the Second World's Fair, which was in 1962, which actually they were hoping to get it done by 1959 and have it be a 50th anniversary thing, but I guess they couldn't finish the Space Needle in time or something like that. But it's about a... Well, to give you a little bit of the backdrop... During that World's Fair, they had themed days, and so one day it was an agricultural day, and they would raffle off a bushel of wheat, and the next day it's a farming day, and they'd raffle off a cow, and one day they raffled off a child, and no one knows what happened to this child, and he was donated by the Washington Receiving's Home, and so the story reimagines this child's fate, and this what happened to him in those interim years. So that's what I'm working on now. Other questions? Yes, please.
Not to apply any pressure.
No pressure. Yeah.
But to help you overcome your fear of failure. Sure. Successful. Do you have an idea about the one after that?
Nice. Yeah. The question is, what are you working on in 2037? Not to put too much pressure on, but... the question, it's interesting. I'm curious as to what other writers, what's going on, what's occupying their brains. Because for me, I fall in love with whatever I'm working on at the moment. And so I love the story of Willow Frost and William. And that's out there in the world, and it's there for everyone to partake. But I'm currently all about these new characters that are in my mind. But in the back of my mind, I'm quietly gathering research materials for the next book, which is super top secret, and I can't know. I actually have some yearnings to write a young adult book, YA book, and so I've gradually, I mean, even while I was working on Hotel, I was gathering materials and sort of putting in this little corner of my office for that project, and hopefully I'll get around to that. Another story may pop up like a prairie dog and occupy my attention, so you never know, but there are other projects out there. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, please.
Tell me about your research, because it seems like you spend a fair amount of time getting real people in your book.
Yeah, tell me about the question was about research, and because I do use real people, my characters are made up, but I tend to have other just ancillary characters pop up on the stage once in a while. Like in this book, it's there are references to Anna May Wong and Step and Fetch It and things like that. Research-wise, you know, I love research. Research for me is really fun. I could almost do that to the exclusion of all else, and eventually I have to get back to the writing. I collect stuff and from the period, magazines, newspapers. I like yearbooks because I like to see what kids are writing to one another, you know, 8 years ago. It's really fascinating. I have lots of the typical out-of-print academic-type books, but I also go to the places. And so in Songs of Willow Frost, there's the Sacred Heart Orphanage, which was a real place. It was a real place where the great author of the West, Wallace Stegner, was one of those orphans. He and his brother were there for 9 months until his mother returned to retrieve them. And I went to the place, and it's now the Villa Academy, which is a private school. And Laurelhurst is a very Tony neighborhood in North Seattle. And I went and walked the facility, and I refer to a sacred grotto, and the remnant of the grotto is still there. It's this moss covered, ivy-strewn little nook hidden in the trees, but it's still there. And so I go to the places, and I like museums because people love to go to museums because they're wonderful, but as a researcher, I can go and beg access to archival materials. And so at the Wing Luke Museum, I get to put on the white archivist gloves and go into the basement and step through the door, and it feels like I'm Howard Carter stepping into King Tut's tomb, you know, and it's just all there. And so that's part of what I do. That's as far as referencing real people, I think those people existed, and their personal circumstances lend another layer to the historical context and the context with regard to race relations and things like that. Characters like Step and Fetch It and Anna May Wong, who were so popular in their day and then later so reviled, or in their own cultures, they were, you know, Anna May Wong in her latter years went back to China and they hated her, felt that she had completely sold out, and there's heartache in just knowing the backstory in these little bit players as well, and you add these to the mix, and I think it adds another layer of something. That's a great question. Wow, not only do you look alike, but your hands went up at exactly the same time. It's like synchronized questions. That's amazing. How do you do that? Either one. Or if you want to ask the question simultaneously, we can do that.
My question is, how much of a book do you write before you show it to somebody else, and who do you show it to?
Did everyone hear that question? Okay. Well, the great thing is when no one can hear the question, I can make it up. And so what she asked was, how is it that you get to be so strikingly handsome? And the question is about how much research do I do before I write? And am I paraphrasing this correctly?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now I totally, yeah, lay it on me again.
How much of the book do you write? How much writing do you do before you show it to another person?
Who do I show it to? How much writing do I do before I show it to another living, breathing human being? I finish the whole book before I show it to the Prime Minister. I mean, my wife. And the holy trinity of my literary life is, it goes from my wife, my agent, my editor, but I've learned, and it was the appropriate process with Hotel and Willow, is I just trust my gut until I get to the end, rather than have people taste egg and baking soda and a little flour and tell me if the cake is good. I just have to trust that it's going to come out of the oven and be something presentable. And that's how I do it. There's a part of me that wants that reassurance. I've written 100 pages. I just want to know that this is, you know, salient work. But writers are plagued with their own self-doubt. And when you get input along the way, I think it triggers those mechanisms. And so I avoid all that. I just stay in storyland. I embrace my characters. I write the story I want to write, and then I do whatever my wife tells me to do. And you had a question, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it hard for you to separate yourself from the last character, before you start writing about the new character, to kind of, make sure they're completely different from one another?
Yeah. Is it hard to separate yourself from the last character and start something new? It is a little bit. I really believe in writing characters that have immortal souls. And I think a lot of us have books or movies. And, you know, Rick and Ilsa from Casablanca are immortal beings in my mind. They have a story that is continued off the screen. And I'm curious as to where they are today. And so I look at characters like that. And at some point, you have to let them go and let them do their own thing for a while. So I do. I sort of grieve those characters, and they occupy my thoughts for a while. And I have to divorce myself from that a little bit. But I find that once I set some things in motion with a new story, I'm all in. I'm vested in that story. And then those characters become my darlings, and what happens to them on a daily basis is my chief concern. So there is a little pause, but it's not a great pause. But that's a total... you probably have that same experience where you finish a good book, and you're not ready to start a new book. You just want to just feel that book. Or go get the sequel, that kind of thing. Give me the next one. I have that same feeling sometimes as a writer, and I would imagine most writers do. Yes, please.
Do you have a certain time of day you write, and how many hours do you spend a day writing?
Sure. To have a certain time of day that I write, and how many hours do I spend writing? I write exactly at the stroke of midnight, I always picture that's how Anne Rice used to work, She wears all black and goes into the crematory of a condemned hotel and, writes at midnight. I write, I get up in the morning and I tend to write from 8 to about 1 in the afternoon. The default time, because when my children go to school, now they're teenagers and they can make their own breakfast and, find their own gym shorts and off they go. I really need 4 consecutive hours. I know some authors, they can write in airports and they can write at bus stops and write on airplanes, and I have a hard time henpecking the work. I need 4 contiguous hours. Otherwise, it kind of drives me a little bonkers. And then I take a break. Normal things, eat lunch, take a shower, go for a run, whatever, catch up on emails. And then I tend to edit what I was working on maybe till 3 o'clock, and then I'm done. And when I'm writing, when I'm really writing, I'm not writing right now because I'm touring, but when I'm really writing, when I get back home and I'm back in the thick of it again, I write every single day until life interrupts. So I'll write 7 days a week. I'll write 10 days in a row. As much as I can, I stay parked in storyland. And that's what works best for me. And I could write all day. I could put in a wonderful 15-hour day, but then I would burn out a little bit, or a lot. And I really like retiring from the story in the afternoon when I'm still chomping at the bit to get words on the page, because then the next morning I pop right out of bed and I'm ready to get back to the story. And that's what works for me. Yeah, you bet. Yes, Helene.
Do you type or handwrite?
Do I type or handwrite? I work on a laptop, and that, you know, I have voluminous notes, handwritten notes, and things that populate my desk. But I really, you know, I'm really comfortable with a laptop. But I know Pat Conroy writes everything longhand in stacks of yellow legal pads, and I think that's amazing. I know there are some authors that have written a single, you know, they traditionally use a computer, but as an exercise, they're like, I'm going to write this book longhand, and they go for it. And they never tend to stay with it. You know, it's like the one noble exercise. I've never known someone that says, I'm going to go to, you know, paper and ink, and they never, you know, they stay there. They always come running, screaming back to, you know, their computer. Yes, please.
Do you do a layout so you can kind of know where this character is going to start and where it ends? Or do you just kind of make it up as you go?
Yeah, the question is, do I have a layout of where the characters are going? Do I plot everything out? Do I have an outline, if you will? I don't work from an outline, but where I work is I have a premise and a place and a time period, and I have a beginning and I have an ending, and the ending is almost more important than my beginning. I can find different ways to begin it, but the ending is the ending becomes my magnetic north. It points me in the right direction, and then as I'm writing, I will only really think. It's like a chess game. I can only think maybe three moves ahead, and three scenes ahead or three chapters ahead, and I don't really write it out, but it's in my mind. And the ending becomes important because if I write myself off into some crazy tangent and I know I can't get back to the ending, then I have to cut those chapters and go to the return to the taproot of my story. That's how I do it, because I like knowing where I'm going, but I still like the discovery process as I go. And I know some authors, they will write a 35-page outline chapter by chapter, and it becomes an exercise in filling in the blanks, and they're very comfortable, and their discovery process happens early on. But I like the daily basis of the day-by-day satisfaction of it's almost the same reading experience as a reader has, where you want to read what happens next, and then that leads you to want to know what happens after that and after that. Yes, sir.
Since your protagonists are always young people, I'm curious how being a father has affected how you look at the experience of this kind of emerging into teenage years of life.
Sure. Yeah. The question is, in Hotel and Willow, I have protagonists that are young characters. I mean, Willow is an older character, but William certainly is a young character. And how does having teenagers affect that storytelling? It doesn't really affect these stories in particular, but in the back of my mind, because of my teenagers, I got in the habit of reading a lot of YA. I read a lot of young adult books. Just it started when they were very little, 11, 12-year-old, where I'm not reading to them anymore, and they're discovering books on their own, and I wanted to read what they're reading to know if it's age-appropriate or whatever, or just books that I thought they would enjoy. And then we would read things together, because this book is so great, they have to read it, or they'd read something that's so great, I would have to read it. And so my kids have affected me in that I have a really deep appreciation for young adult literature. I think it's some of the finest storytelling out there right now, pure storytelling. I mean, it's just I mean, like John Green's The Fault in Our Stars is just brilliant. I mean, it's just so wonderful, painful, poignant, honest, and true. I think sometimes that kind of powerful storytelling can get lost in the literary jujitsu of language. And so having my kids expose me to really powerful YA books like Laurie Halse Anderson, just great stuff, has made me realize that is a canvas that I want to be a part of. And I relate really well to young characters. It's part of it is probably it's lacking in maturity or forever, you know, 12 in my mind or something like that. But I enjoy young protagonists because not everything is set in stone for them. There's really a lot of wiggle room for personal growth. And I think those are great characters to set, you know, to wind them up and set them in motion on the stage. Yeah, please.
Well, kind of along those same lines, take us back in time a little bit to perhaps your teenage years. Was writing always a passion, obviously music was important in your life, did you always have that drive to be a storyteller, or did you enjoy writing?
Yeah, I mean, the question is, did I write as a kid? Did I enjoy storytelling as in my youth? And I mean, oddly enough, my degree is in art and design, and so I was one of those kids that always had a sketchbook, and so I was always drawing. I wanted to be the next Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko or Stan Lee, I comic books and graphic novels and things like that. But I also, as a kid, I was the world's worst poet. I mean, I love poetry, I love slam poetry, but as a kid in my sketchbook, I go back and I'm like, wow. I wrote a lot in those sketchbooks, part of it was my mom loved poetry and kind of imprinted that on me as a small child. But then I went to art school, I worked as a designer, as an art director, and when you're in that field, you're pimping your creative soul by the hour. And I went back to those moments in my youth when I was most happiest, and it was when I was really freestyle creating, whether I was drawing or I was writing short stories. You know, I was the editor of the high school magazine, you know, the stuff like that. So I always had I was doing the art side, visual arts, but I had another foot in the written word and an appreciation for that. I was just one of those weird kids that... And I go. I visit high schools now, and I can pick out my, my twin in the typical classroom, because I was that kid that in English where we'd read a book, and I would love this book, and everyone else hated it. You know, I would be that guy, because I always felt everything, and I was okay with that. And if you're that kind of person, I think as a kid, you tend to want to write because you want to express those feelings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
What about movies?
I like movies. Movies are fine.
Cross becoming a movie, or a hotel becoming a movie. What do you want to protect them?
No. The question is about movies, and it comes up a lot with Hotel in the Corner, Bitter and Sweet. It was a play in Seattle, which did the whole run in Seattle as a play. Sold out. They sold out 39 shows, which I thought it was an okay book, but it was an amazing play. I loved it as a play. They did me one better. And so the extension of that is movies. People ask about this a lot. And it's Hollywood is like selling your baby to the circus, you know? It is. And it's, yeah, you know, it might work out. You might show up at the circus and your baby's flying through the air on the trapeze, or is the ringmaster, or they might be like, nope, sorry, your baby's in the freak show tent biting the heads off of chickens, you know? You just don't know. And so it's not that I'm protective of Hotel as a film, but I think Hollywood is confused by Hotel as a film, because my main characters are two Asian kids, and Hollywood works on less from a creative standpoint, and you know, it's an accountant driven art where they find, okay, Tom Cruise, we could pay him $20 million and put him in a spacesuit, and this will net us $100 million overseas. Make up a story. It's almost reverse of how stories should be created. And so maybe it'll happen, but I'm not holding my breath. With Willow, it's interesting because I think my film agent believes Willow has a better chance because the character Willow Frost is an adult, and so there's a role for an adult female. But also, I've spent time in Hollywood listening to producers and having them ask me over and over again, how do we mitigate the financial risk without a white male lead? Which drives me bonkers when I hear that. So because of that mentality, the mentality that cranks out, you know, Transformers 7 and, you know that everything is sort of a franchise film, Saw 23 and stuff like that. So I'm just not interested in that kind of Hollywood. So I would rather it not be made than to stand here and apologize to you for why it's a terrible film. So, maybe one last question. Yes, sir.
Did you write the play?
Oh, did I write the play? It's interesting that the Book at Theater in Seattle adapts books exclusively, and they pull the dialogue exactly from the book. And so they have a very unique way of adapting the play, and so it retains the integrity of the author's words, which I wasn't sure how that would work. I went to the first cast reading, and they had a cast of 26, which was amazing, and a lot of extras. And I had the cast reading was at the Panama Hotel in the tea room, and I'm sitting there, and they have the lighting designer and the music designer and the set designer, and they're presenting all this stuff, and then they did their first cast read through, and I had to leave after about 20 minutes. It was so weird, and I was so nervous, and I wanted to see it fresh, and I went to the opening night, and I have a friend, Stevie Kalos, who is a wonderful author, but she also has a background in theater, and she said, you never appreciate acting until actors are performing your words. And it was true. I thought the words on the page had a certain life and a certain vivacity, but then when you saw the nuances that really good actors brought to it, I was amazed. So, yes, answer to your question, I wrote it, but someone else adapted it beautifully from those words, and the actors brought it to life. Thank you for braving the weather. Thank you for being here. And for those of you that couldn't be here and are listening to the podcast, I hope you had a wonderful night, and we're thinking of you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.